You might have heard the story about the great orchestral conductor, Sir Thomas Beecham. It's one of those apocryphal stories that I would just love to be true. Beecham was conductor of the Halle Orchestra in Manchester. On one occasion in the late 1940s, he was conducting a big gala concert. And afterwards, he attended a reception for the great and the good who were there. He got into conversation with one woman. He kind of recognized her, but couldn't quite place her. So he tried that old technique of asking a few questions in the hope that something would jog his memory. So it kind of went, I hope that you're well. Yes, very well, thank you. And your husband? Yes, he's well. Tell me, what's he doing nowadays? Oh, he's still the king. How embarrassing. Not recognizing that the lady you were speaking to is the queen. And yet, I think that a lot of people have just that problem with Jesus. It's a bit like those mystery guests earlier. They sort of recognize bits about him, but that's really as far as it goes. It was, of course, a problem which Jesus' own disciples had. If you were here last week, you'll know that Debbie started this series following the last few weeks of Jesus' life, as we find it in Mark's Gospel. And it was only in Mark 8:29, that's more than halfway through Mark's Gospel, that you find someone who finally did recognize who Jesus was. Peter answered, "You're the Messiah." But what does that mean? We saw last week that Jesus' disciples completely misunderstood that. And although, as we saw earlier on the mountain, they did see Jesus' glory revealed, it still leaves that question. What does it all mean? And particularly, what's it got to do with me? So as we follow the next section of Mark, I actually think we're going to find a snapshot, just right in the center of Mark, the snapshot of who Jesus was, what he came to do, and how he was going to do it. Why don't we turn now to Mark chapter 9, quite a long reading, but Peter's going to come and read it for us.
Today's reading is taken from Mark chapter 9, verses 2 to 32, and can be found on page 1012 of your pew Bibles. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up on a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud. "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, "Why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first?" Jesus replied, "To be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it is written about him." When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. "What are you arguing with them about?" he asked. A man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son, who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not." "You unbelieving generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? "How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has he been like this?" "From childhood," he answered. "It is often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." "If you can," said Jesus, "everything is possible for one who believes." Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the impure spirit. "You deaf and mute spirit," he said, "I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, "He's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. After Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, "Why couldn't we drive it out?" He replied, This kind can come out only by prayer." They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were, because he was teaching his disciples. He said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." But they did not understand what he meant and were afraid to ask about it. I am afraid to ask him about it. This is the word of the Lord.
So it's 6 days after the events we looked at last week. Jesus takes Peter, James and John, his three closest disciples, and went up. It was probably Mount Hermon. And there, Jesus was transfigured. It was as though, just for that moment, the disciples were able to see just something of his awesome majesty. And it's interesting, isn't it? There are so many people who would say that they believe in Jesus, but what they mean by that is they believe Jesus was just a good man, a great teacher, a healer, somebody who was wonderful, but nothing more. But actually what happened on that mountain shows us that Jesus was so much more than just a good man, so much more than just the greatest of men even. And it wasn't just what happened, it was also what was said. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my Son whom I love." That was God's verdict on Jesus. Jesus is God's Son. And actually what happens straight after that, I think, reinforces it. They come down from the mountain and straight into a tragic situation. This poor father is in turmoil because of his son. "Teacher, I brought you my son who's possessed by a spirit that's robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth and becomes rigid." That was bad enough, but there was more. "It has often thrown him into fire or water to kill him." Can you imagine how desperate this father was, constantly having to be on his guard, constantly watching his son in case he did something dangerous. And behind it all, some evil spirit. I guess it might sound strange to our increasingly secularized Western world. We just don't normally think in terms of evil spirits. But of course the reality is that there is evil in the world. Now, if you doubt that, please turn your television on sometime today. Look at the news. It'll convince you. And sometimes that evil does attack people and ruin people's lives. And you find that it was something that happened with added intensity during Jesus' ministry. The powers of evil seemed to have gone into overdrive when Jesus was on earth. The Son of God had come into the world and they were on the offensive against him. Jesus' disciples were powerless against that kind of evil. But all it took was a word from Jesus. "You deaf and mute spirit," he said, "I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." And the spirit left him. Even the powers of evil couldn't stand against Jesus, the Son of God. And then, having seen Jesus revealed in his glory, having witnessed his amazing authority, as Jesus moves on with his disciples, he said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." I guess by and large, we are so used to knowing about Jesus' death and resurrection that we can kind of miss how bizarre this sounded. Last week we saw Peter recognize that Jesus was the Messiah, and straight away Jesus spoke about his coming death. And now we see Jesus' glory and authority, and again he speaks about his coming death. If you can step back from what we know about the situation, this just seems strange. It just doesn't seem to make sense. So let's go back to the start, back to the mountain. Jesus was transfigured. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Now, Elijah and Moses were two of the greatest Old Testament figures. There was Moses, the one who gave the law, and Elijah, the first and the greatest of the prophets. And in a sense, Moses and Elijah sum up the whole of the Old Testament. You'll find the Old Testament in the New Testament. The Old Testament is referred to as the law and the prophets. Moses and Elijah just sum it up. But more than that, Moses and Elijah sum up the Old Testament dilemma. Because the law, which was given through Moses, was never of itself enough to keep God's people on track. In fact, in Romans, Paul says that the purpose of the law was to convince people that we're sinners. We might know what God requires of us, but that doesn't mean we'll be able to do it. And in fact, it's actually being exposed to what God requires of us that makes us realize just how far short we fall. And the prophets. Well, the prophets constantly called people back to God, back to keeping the law. But time and again, what you find is there was a kind of half-hearted return to God. But then pretty quickly they went back to doing what they wanted. It's just what happened in the time of Elijah, and it happened time and time again afterwards. They went back to doing what they wanted rather than what God had said. But the prophets also looked forward to the time when God would send the Messiah, the one who would finally live out God's law perfectly, fulfill Moses, and who would rescue people from their sins, fulfill the prophets. So the appearance of Moses and Elijah points to Jesus being the one who would finally break the hold of evil and sin over the world. And that's just what we saw happening in the healing of that boy. But I wonder if you were a bit surprised. Jesus' initial response when he came down from the mountain and saw the crowd there, it was kind of not what you expect, I don't think. "You unbelieving generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you?" Kind of sounds a bit more like Alan Sugar on a bad day, doesn't it? "You useless lot, you're fired." Why? Why that kind of outburst? When, let's face it, his disciples had tried their best to help this poor man and his son. And I've been trying to think about this week. And I think that the problem was that they had tried their best. There's something a bit plaintive in their question to Jesus. "Why couldn't we drive it out?" And Jesus' reply was, this only comes out by prayer. And that kind of, I think, must highlight the fact that they hadn't been praying. They hadn't been depending on God. They thought they could do it themselves. It's in Jesus do it. Surely that was what being disciples was about. You watch Jesus do it, and then you go and do it yourselves. Surely all they had to do was copy him. And if you step back from that a bit, what you see is that the disciples were still really seeing Jesus as a great teacher. They still hadn't realized that they needed so much more than someone who could show them what to do. So much more than someone who could show them how to live. That's why Jesus had this outburst, I think, about them being an unbelieving generation, because they still hadn't got it, despite everything they'd seen, everything they'd heard. They still hadn't got it. They thought that they needed someone to show them the way. But what they really needed was to someone who could deal with the fact that even when they were shown the way, they could never follow it. They couldn't defeat evil, because they had to realize that evil wasn't just out there, it actually lurked inside each of them. And that's why Jesus, talking about his death so soon afterwards, does follow on naturally from this. Moses and Elijah were a reminder that just having the law and the prophets was not enough. We don't need someone to tell us how to live God's way. We need someone who can defeat that kind of, that twist inside us which always wants to go our way instead. We need someone who can take not just the obvious evil of this traumatized father and his tragic son and deal with it, but someone who can deal in the same way with the far less obvious evil which lurks inside every human heart. We need someone who's never been touched by sin to deal with our sin for us, because we just cannot do it ourselves. And the only way that was going to happen would be if someone took on himself all the evil of the world, all that is wrong and spoils life, including all that's wrong inside me and you. Someone who could die with all of that on him and then take it away to hell and destroy it, and so defeat it. But who could possibly do that? Who could possibly do that if we're all implicated in the problem? Only the one whose glory we saw on the mountain. Someone whose authority we saw in that tragic family scene. Only Jesus, the Son of God, could deal with this problem. And so, having showed his glory, having demonstrated his authority, he then talks about the only way in which it was going to be possible for that to be true, not just for that father and his son, but for everyone, including us. But it all happened a long time ago. So what does it mean? What does it mean for you and me this morning? I actually think that, as so often is the case with the Bible, it not only tells us about what's happened, it just holds a mirror up to us so we can see ourselves. And I think there's three ways you may be able to see yourself in here this morning. You see, maybe this morning you are like most of the people gathered at the bottom of the mountain. You know about Jesus, you've heard some of what he says, you think he's a great teacher, you think that if we all put into practice what Jesus said, the world would be a much better place. But while that's true, I'm afraid that if that is what you think, then what Jesus says to you this morning is, you unbelieving generation. You see, Jesus did not come to show us how to live. He came because we can't do it. And if you think you can, if you think that you can live a good life and follow Jesus in your own strength, then you're making just the same mistake as the people then. You see, it may sound a hard thing to say, but what all this morning shows us is that to believe that Jesus was a good man and a great teacher and nothing more is actually to disbelieve in Jesus. Jesus, the Son of God, the one whose glory we saw on the mountain, came to die. He knew that. And let's face it, there had to be a deadly serious reason for him doing that. And that reason is that you need saving from your sins. That's why Jesus came. And that's what you need. But maybe this morning, you're not quite like that. Maybe the person here you can identify with is that father. I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. And did you notice, Jesus did not criticize him for saying that. You see, I think this is one of the great prayers of all time. to tell Jesus that you want to believe, but you're really struggling to do it. This is different from those who kind of got their mind made up that Jesus is just a great teacher and that's it. Now, this is somebody who wants to believe, but is really struggling. So, you know, maybe there are things about the gospel that just don't make sense to you. Maybe you were here last week when we looked at Jesus saying, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. And you just aren't sure you could cope with that. How can I do that? Well, what this says to you is, please don't give up. Don't turn away. He used the same prayer that man used. I do believe, help me overcome my unbelief. Because I think that is the prayer that God delights to answer. And that's why we run Christianity Explored. It's why we run Life Explored. It's because we want to help people who are like that guy just be able to join the dots up. But maybe lastly, you are trusting and following Jesus this morning. There is actually a word here for you as well. That voice from the cloud on the mountain. This is my son whom I love. Listen to him. And of course, when the Bible talks about listening, it means listen and pay attention and do something about it, kind of really take it on board. And be realistic, we have to say, no matter how long you've been a Christian, listening to Jesus will not always come naturally. You see, when the Bible tells you what you expect it to say, when you read the Bible and you find what you want it to say, that's great. No problem listening then. But when the Bible challenges you, makes you feel uncomfortable, maybe even offends you and annoys you, not always so easy to listen then, is it? But you see, if you've recognized who Jesus is, this glorious Son of God, then not to listen to him has to be a sin, doesn't it? So an amazing story and a mirror. And I guess the challenge for each of us this morning is, are you willing to look into that mirror? Not just to read it as something that happened a long time ago, although of course it did, but to see it as something that you are engaged with. This morning, can you look in here, see how it challenges you, and then respond to that challenge?